This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. As a young man, author Carl Nordgren was a fishing guide, spent his summers at the English River in Ontario, Canada. He was taken in by a family of Ojibwe First Nation people, and he wanted to stay with them as a fishing guide for the rest of his life. But an environmental disaster changed those plans. A nearby pulp mill had been dumping mercury into the river for years, and its toxic effects were beginning to take shape and be felt all around the region. Few people have heard about the disaster that still affects the Ojibwe people, so Nordgren wrote a novel, and then two more. The first is the River of Lakes trilogy. The first one is called The 53rd Parallel. Carl Nordgren joins us now to talk about that. He's an author and professor of creative entrepreneurship at Duke University. Carl, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
Tell us about those summers as a fishing guide in Ontario.
It was extraordinary. It was so extraordinary. It was my last two summers of high school, my first two summers of college. I recall so vividly the first day. I was on my way to what was described to me as a frontier town, the town of Kenora, Ontario, the frontier town where the bush planes were, where they flew out to the camps. And I was a boy who grew up. This is 1967. I'm in my mid-60s. I was a young boy who grew up.
It was the mid-60s, but you were in your mid-teens.
I was in my teens at the time. Correct. Okay. Correct. Thank you. And I'm a boy who wanted to grow up to be a cowboy. I was a boy who wanted to grow up to be a French voyageur. So when I learned that I was going to a frontier town, that just informed my trip. And I got to Kenora. I found the float plane docks. I found the plane that was going to take me to the fishing camp. I helped load the plane with drums of oil for it to fly in fishing camp. We have to bring in all the supplies. And so there I am on the airplane, a Norseman, with one other passenger, the gentleman who ran the camp store, an Anglo from Kenora. And two things happened on that flight that just defined that trip for me. Again, I'm at that point, I'm just so excited about being in this frontier town, about this adventure beginning. Well, I begin to get airsick on the plane. I became very airsick on the plane. The fumes of that oil just filled the plane. I had flown very little in my life up until then. There was a choppiness in the air, and I began to get sick, and I began to get so embarrassed that I would arrive at this great wilderness adventure as the kid who couldn't even handle the float plane trip coming on into the camp. Well, that began to sour my stomach, but then it got worse when the store manager realized that I was an American, and it is 1967, and the Vietnam War is raging, and he immediately decides that he's going to tell me all the things that America has done wrong and damns me in association with that. And so I'm in terrible shape when that plane arrives at the dock at the fishing camp. Well, this young fellow, a young Ojibwe boy named Little Stevie, he was introduced to me as Little Stevie. He must have just intuited this. He must have seen that I was on my back foot when I arrived. And he came and he immediately embraced me on that dock, put his arm around my shoulder, helped me clean up the mess that I had made in the plane, introduced me to his family, the Loon Clan, and I began to understand that this was a clan of Ojibwe Indians that there in 1967 were known for still never having lived on the reserve, were one of the last off-the-reserve clans of Ojibwe Indians. And he was going to be my partner that summer. He was going to be the person who was going to teach me how to be the camp laborer that I was that first summer as I was becoming an apprentice fishing guide. And so as he would take me out on the water to show me the river and its lakes, he would also stop at the Ojibwe burial site and show that to me. He would also stop at the flat wall of rock where the pictographs had been painted decades ago, centuries ago, as well as currently, and show that to me. So he introduced me to this Aboriginal, precious, fragile life just before it ended. And I was forever captivated by the fact that I was there at that time. So that was the first of four summers. I did intend to work forever as a fishing guide. In college, I went to a school that had that funky trimester period where the fall term ended at Thanksgiving and the winter term didn't begin until the first week of January. So those 6 weeks that I had in the winter, I began to guide down in Arkansas on the White River.
I was going to say, you weren't up in Ontario fishing then unless you got a saw and a
That's right, not unless it was ice fishing.
Yeah.
So that's what I was going to be. I was going to be a fishing guide in the north in the warm months. I was going to be a fishing guide in Arkansas during the cooler winter months. And I was going to be a writer. And then halfway through my junior year in college, I got a phone call from the camp owner, and the camp owner explained to me that I probably should go check myself into the hospital to determine if I had mercury poisoning, for in fact, it was discovered that the English River, this north-flowing river system, headed its way towards Hudson Bay, that the English River was just laced with mercury.
Yeah, so tell us about what you knew about that and the Dryden pulp mill.
Correct.
And its role in all this.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I knew very little. I should check myself in the hospital. This is 1970. There's not the internet. There's not the communications that there is today. It was really very hard to stay abreast of the story. I checked myself in the hospital. I was free and clear. But what was discovered was that south on the river, again, this is a north-flowing river, south on the river in the late 50s, as office automation is becoming a thing in America, it's no longer just typewriters, but Xerox machines are arriving. And because Xerox machines are arriving, we need a new quality of paper. We need a harder, shinier paper that can quickly slip through this office automation. And the first process that anybody came up with to create such a paper there in the late 50s was a mercury-based process. Environmental ignorance being what it was at the time in the late 50s, the Ontario provincial government actually permitted the Dryden Pulp Company to dump the mercury right into the river.
You know, I find that a little shocking because we did know that mercury was a heavy metal.
Yes, we knew it was a heavy metal, but we were just discovering what was going on in Japan with Minamata Bay. That was, you know, that was known there, but that wasn't known here yet. In fact, Barney, the camp owner, brought the scientists from Japan to the river to make the final diagnosis of what was wrong with the river. So they wound up dumping 30,000 tons, it was determined, 30,000 tons of mercury, a heavy enough contaminant, as you say, that it took a while for it to flow as far north as we were. But Barney realized there in the late 60s, as 1970 approached, that this epidemic of health problems that was occurring in the Ojibwe population, who were eating mercury-laced fish a couple of times a day, there had to be something wrong here. Initially, the Canadian government tried to stonewall it. They weren't eager. The doctors who were working for the Canadian government diagnosed this as what happens when Aboriginal people quickly shift to a modern diet, to which little Stevie, my friend who greeted me there that very first day, who grew up to be the youngest elected chief of Grassy Narrows Reserve, his name is Steve Phobister, he became famous for saying, yes, this is exactly what happens when we begin to eat a modern diet that's laced with mercury.
With mercury. Well, therein, just right there, lies a cautionary tale. We knew something was wrong with mercury. I'm talking about now Canadian, the Ontario provincial officials. But, you know, something's wrong. You may not know every last detail. You may not have every last report about what's wrong. But before you go ahead and let them just dump it in the river, you might want to do some more investigation. You don't want to just say, we know enough. Let's just go ahead with it.
That's right.
That was back in the I guess, 50s when they were allowed it, right?
Right. And we've
learned a lesson since then.
Well, there was this notion in the 50s that you know, of course, then mercury was still in thermometers.
Right.
The notion then was that you're in more danger from the glass of the thermometer breaking in your mouth than you are with the mercury. So there was this really very casual attitude, at least there in the 50s, about the significance of mercury, at least in that neck of the woods.
But what's the evidence that's showing up along the camp and among the Ojibwe people? What are we seeing?
80-90% of the folks have got serious health problems, kidney failure, fetal failure. Steve Phobister, my friend, who I've become reacquainted with, was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease 10 years ago. That's not what he has, but those are the symptoms that occur when this heavy metal poisoning takes over one's body. He's on oxygen. He is in slowly debilitating condition that is getting worse every year. And so the other challenge that came to this, and one of the reasons why I felt so compelled to write these stories, is that back in the 1880s, when the Ojibwe Indians signed their peace treaties with the Canadian government, they signed away their rights to sue the Canadian government. Well, the Dryden Company was a subsidiary of the special category of a Canadian corporation called Crown Corporations. And if you achieve that status, the protection of the Crown of the Canadian government adheres to you. So these Ojibwe were not able to sue these folks for the damage that occurred. And so for a couple of decades, they were suffering deeply because it was a double whammy. At the same time that all these camps closed, these fishing camps closed because of the mercury poisoning, is about the same time that the pulp and lumber companies are switching from a lumberjack extraction to clear cutting. So they're losing all their lumberjack jobs at the same time. So the health problems are 80-90%. Unemployment is 80-90%. And to this day, they still haven't recovered. Mm. And so my goal is to tell those stories to the largest audiences I can possibly tell them to, so that perhaps when their stories get told, there'll be some justice that will follow.
I am talking to Carl Nordgren, who is an author and a Duke professor. He's written a series of novels, the first, The 53rd Parallel, which brings us to this question. It's an important story, and up to now, the story you've told is absolutely true. Why write a novel?
Well, because I'm not a researcher. I know who I am, and I'm not a researcher. There's a marvelous nonfiction book that needs to be written here about what actually happened, but I'm not a researcher, and so I thought to myself, if I'm going to take on the task of telling their story, my predisposition all my life to be a novelist. When I was 12 years old, I had two goals in life, was to play shortstop for the Chicago Cubs. I gave up on that about 10 years ago. And to be a novelist, and I started that about 10 years ago.
Well, and you're working your way into a Hemingway fiction by going to the fishing camp. I think that's a great start.
Yes.
So give us a sense now. Will you read for us from your novel, The 53rd Parallel?
I'm going to read from the very first chapter. In fact, this is the first chapter. It's a page and a half. And so this is a story where bigger-than-life Irish characters come together with Ojibwe Indians in northwest Ontario and create just a heaven on earth, and this is what precedes that story. This is the first chapter is called This Man Rides the Moose. With so much light absorbed in the full rolling clouds of fog floating over the river's lake and shrouding the fir and birch forests, it seemed like dusk all day. At the far end of the lake, where the current collected its force to return to the river's channel, some of the clouds were smoke. A large animal was swimming in the middle of the lake, lost now in a fog cloud, then seen as a shadow before it emerged. It was a big bull moose, his heavy muzzle held just above the water's surface, his dewlap submerged, his large ears folded back, a massive rack of antlers trailing a stalk of broken reed behind. The drifting silver-white clouds just above hid the sky. The big bull's bulk was hidden under the water, and his neck cut a modest wake. Following the moose at some distance, veiled in a large curtain of cloud, then appearing, and only slowly closing the gap, was a gracefully rounded long-nosed birch-bark canoe paddled by this man. Before his people were called Ojibwe by the French voyageurs and then Chippewa by the English fur traders, they called themselves Anishinaabe, for they were the original people, the first people. And this man had been a great Anishinaabe hunter and a courageous warrior. He was dressed in light buckskin leggings and a jacket. A heavily beaded pouch draped over his shoulders and crossed at his chest, repeating the floral pattern painted on the bow of his canoe. He wore a bright red wrap around his head, and his hair fell with the extra cloth over his shoulders. The tip of a foxtail was woven into his hair just above his right ear. This man paddled once hard to glide, paddled twice hard to glide. The first glide revealed the image of a fox carved into one side of the paddle blade, and with the next stroke and glide, the image carved on the opposite side of the blade was revealed, a rabbit dashing away. This man paddled to a rhythm that he began to hum deep in his chest as he followed the moose across the lake. He drew close enough to hear the moose snorting a heavy breath, then kept that distance and followed the moose across the lake. The moose approached the thickest cloud as somewhere a loon cried, and the fog clouds captured the trilling wail of high tremolo calls and kept reviving them as they echoed everywhere. When he saw the moose approaching the thick cloud, this man paddled faster to close the distance. He paddled right up behind the moose, and as the broken bit of reed washed free from the antlers and swirled first in the moose's wake and then twirled in the paddle's whirlpool. This man pulled hard with his paddle one last time, then dropped it as the canoe darted alongside the moose. This man looked up to a break in the fog where he could see blue sky. He heard a song floating muffled from the shore. It seemed to be from another world, and he stood and sang a welcome from his world. When the clouds broke and he could hear the song more fully, he raised his voice to join the others. It was the Path of Souls' song. And just as they disappeared into the cloud, this man leapt from the canoe onto the moose's back and sang louder still.
Carl Nordgren reading from his novel, The 53rd Parallel. Tell us, Carl, because there's an interesting element that you bring into this as well, an Irish emigre who is himself the sort of the victim of colonialization, right? Who goes and becomes a kind of an ambiguous force in that region.
Well, the two Irish characters are very flawed. There's a man and a woman that come to build the fishing camp. Brian is somebody who's perpetrated a terrible act within his family, and so he's been exiled from his village. But he's had for years a dream. He's found a magazine article that talks about the cheap, cheap, cheap land in Canada and invites people to come and buy this land to create jobs, as the article says, for the redmen of Canada. And so that becomes Brian's dream, is to get to Canada to build this extraordinary fishing camp. But he's a poor man living in the west of Ireland, a barely a survivor. And he comes across a young woman who has, in her late teenage and early 20 years, worked for the IRA and worked for the IRA quite effectively as a smuggler of bomb-making materials into London for a bombing raid there. Well, she winds up with a cache of money from the IRA that the IRA doesn't know that she has. She links up with Brian, and they head to Canada to build this extraordinary fishing camp. So this Eden, this heaven on earth that they're setting ready to build in Ontario with the Ojibwe Indians— is flawed from the beginning, for it's the capital for the camp is hidden IRA money.
Wonderful story. Carl Nordgren, author and professor of sociology at Duke University, thank you for being with us.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
The book is called The 53rd Parallel. The launch party for the book is tonight, 7 o'clock at the Makery in Durham. That's our program. You can find out more about the book and everything we've talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a program produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and our intern is Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley is the technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.